Today's program is brought to you by Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. For more information, visit brooklynslate.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we bring the culture to horticulture. So today, it's our Thanksgiving show.
Yes.
It's time to think about the great stuff in our lives and also to be thankful for all the things that we have. Health and food and family, freedom of religion, democracy. All those good things. It always makes me think of Jamestown and the Plymouth Plantation and the hardships that occurred for our benefit. So today we're going to go to the source, the historic source of our contemporary abundance. Mm-hmm. We're going to speak to the gardeners at the Plymouth Plantation. But first...
Yes, we have our horticultural honor roll. Thank you, Joe. That's great. This week, the horticultural honor roll belongs to Sir Francis Bacon for his shout in 1625 for the herb Burnet from his Essay of Gardens, which is one of the most famous essays on gardening. It's often quoted.
Yes.
So when the pilgrims came to this country, they actually brought salad Burnet with them from their native Europe. Now, in his Essay of Gardens, Francis Bacon begins... God Almighty first planted a garden, and indeed, it is the purest of human pleasures. It is the greatest refreshment to the spirits of man, without which buildings and palaces are but gross handiworks, and a man shall ever see that when ages grow to civility and elegancy, men come to build stately sooner than to garden finely, as if gardening were the greater perfection. So perhaps the pilgrims had knowledge of this essay as they came to the New World, because he was a contemporary of theirs.
Yes, yeah.
So he, you know, he was a philosopher, a scientist, so that's why, and a great thinker that still influences us today. So, Sir Francis Bacon, you are our honoree, posthumously.
Right. So, Carmen, do you want to go on about Burnet?
And about Burnet, he was quite fond of this plant for its decorative value, as well as when planted on garden pathways to perfume the air most delightfully, being trodden on and crushed, unquote.
People don't write like that anymore.
No, they don't. The scientific name for Burnet is Potarium sanguisorba, or sanguisorba minor, which translates as drink up blood, referring to its astringent qualities. It has been used to prevent hemorrhages and internal bleeding. And knowing this, soldiers of old would drink tea made from the herb before going into battle in hopes that any wounds they received would be less severe. It was also used as an anti-plague tonic, one of 21 herbs combined and dissolved in wine. So should you get the plague, keep that in mind. Salad Burnet was also very popular in Elizabethan England. At that time, it was not uncommon to be served a goblet of wine with leaves of salad Burnet floating in it. And I quote, to make the heart merry and glad, as also being put in wine, to which it yieldeth a certain grace in the drinking.
So think of that when you're
imbibing
on this Thanksgiving.
Is it available, Alice, generally? I don't know if I've seen it in the market, or even the seeds of it.
Yeah, the seeds are in commerce.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. But let's go to the source of salad Burnet. So today we have the gardeners, the salt of the earth, with us today to talk about the museum, Plymouth Plantation, the gardens, the veggies, the home life, and the history. Lori Danick and Kelly Araujo. Is that how you pronounce it, Kelly?
That's Araujo.
Okay. they're joining us from Plymouth Plantation. Welcome, ladies.
And Plymouth is spelled with an I, by the way, right? P-L-I-M-O-U-T-H.
Actually, actually, it's P-L-I-M-O-T-H.
M-O-T-H.
M-O-T-H.
Yes.
Now, we is the I the original spelling, like the or is that, because I always see it P-L-Y, Plymouth.
Like the town of Plymouth is spelled with a Y.
Yes.
Yes, it is. The town of Plymouth is P-L-Y-M-O-U-T-H, and we chose to differentiate our spelling from the town, so we used an older spelling,
okay.
Bradford's yep. spelling. However, in the 17th century, spelling was totally up to the individual. There were many spellings, and there was no right or wrong.
Okay.
I was wondering if it was the old or original spelling or if it was something just to distinguish contemporary, you know, Plymouth from the plantation. That's very interesting.
So Lori is the head horticulturist and Kelly is the gardener for the 17th century home sites at the museum. And you're also a role player, right, Kelly?
Yes, I am.
Which means you're often in costume and you're interfacing with the public. How's that?
That's wonderful. I love it. I've been here since 2000.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I've been different characters through the years, but I absolutely love it.
Good. So what brings me, I think, to this show and to you all is that in July of 2011, I read an article that was in the New York Times about period vegetable gardens, and I was fascinated. And I still have the article, and I finally got myself together to contact you, and I thought you guys would be great guests for Thanksgiving, so it seemed just right.
Well, thank you.
So before we get into the gardening stuff, I just want to preface that you all have a traditional Thanksgiving dinner at the museum, right?
I think you might be speaking about the dinners that we have for guests that are in our visitor center, not in the village itself in costume, but off-site. We have dinners, 17th century dinners, where visitors come and some pilgrims go in and we walk around and talk to people.
Yeah. Yeah, and the menu seems amazing. You know, it's a traditional menu. It's fall harvest fruits and assorted nuts in a relish tray, and apple cider, split pea soup. You have native turkey with giblet gravy, traditional stuffing with Bell's seasoning, mashed potatoes, butternut squash, white turnips. It's a whole cornucopia of...
I wish I was nearby. I would just come to the dinner instead of making Thanksgiving dinner.
It's probably a lot more fun up there, too.
That's impressive.
Those are wonderful dinners that we have every year in the fall.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because you also have different dinners other than Thanksgiving. You also have different things, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a look at. I'm encouraging our listeners to look online because it was quite impressive. And then you all are there to answer questions. And then you also have heritage breeds, right? You have animals, heritage
we
animals.
Do.
Yeah. Well, the owner of this station is Heritage Food USA, and they're a big advocate and promoter of heritage breeds. So I think we're all in good company here.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, in fact, they started out with turkeys.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they're still making them available, heritage breeds. They basically were responsible for bringing these breeds back into commerce again and made available. So it's possible that, you know, a similar bird was what was served, you know, at the first Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that, you know, in the 1621 harvest, the first harvest that's gotten in, the you're probably going to, you know, they would have had turkey and goose, roasted venison, mussels, probably, you know, duck with cranberries, pumpkin, stewed pumpkin.
Hmm. So tell us about some of the colonial era vegetables that you all grow.
Well, we, in the village, you know, we know that there's a list from 1631, actually, that's a John Winthrop list that he has from a grocer listing, you know, different seeds and there's sorrel seed, endive, dill, and that's on a big list, but that's for Mass Bay, that's later. William Bradford does a poem, and it's printed in, it's 1654. It's a verse, it's in the Mass Historical Society, it's William Bradford verses.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about roots and herbs and gardens grow, parsnips, carrots, turnips, onions, melons, cucumbers, radishes, skirret.
Uh-huh.
The skirrets that you had mentioned.
Is skirrets? Explain to our readers what skirrets are.
Oh, it's a wonderful root that is sort of out of fashion now, which is unfortunate. We have it in the village, and it tastes like a mix of a carrot and a parsnip.
Uh-huh.
And it's when you pull up the roots and they're finger-like, and you'd wash them and scrape them off. You'd roll them in flour and fry them.
Really? Wow.
It's a little bit of work to do, but it's a wonderful dish. And again, we do grow them in the village, and we cook them and eat them, and I love them.
How has that not made its way onto a menu in New York?
Yeah.
Yet?
Or
I am surprised. I have to ask you about... one that's on the list that Alice mentioned, Scorzonera. That sounds like an Italian name. Is that some kind of squash of some sort?
Well, it's a root vegetable also.
Yeah.
However, it's not a vegetable that we represent in our English village.
No.
And I've seen that in the late 1600s on garden lists from New England, but... nothing in the early 1600s.
So it's a root again.
Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to taste similar or to have a slight oystery flavor to it.
Oh.
Which is a little difficult to imagine.
Yeah.
I have never seen that anywhere.
No.
I'm from Italian extraction, so that's why it caught my eye.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back for a minute, though, to Salad Burnett.
Yes.
And talk about it a little from my modern perspective. And Salad Burnett is a perennial vegetable or a perennial herb. I'd like to give it a little bit of a plug. It's about one of my favorite herbs. It has a beautiful lacy look to the leaves. They form a nice mound in the garden, and they stay green well into winter. The little leaves... are fringed, so they're pretty, and they have a cucumber flavor.
Hmm.
So it's nice to pull off leaves and sprinkle them into a salad to add a little bit of flavor and to give a pretty look.
Fresh.
I was going to say
it sounds fresh.
Yes, it's beautiful, and the plant gives a rosy pink flower, and if you pinch off the flowers, you can use them in the salad or as a garnish, and the more you pick the flowers, the more the plant will flower.
Right.
So it's a beautiful addition to a modern herb or vegetable garden.
And it's nice to have a different flavor than the usual.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. So Laura, you said it's a perennial herb, so is it,
yes.
it dies back in the winter and then just grows back?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
That's great.
Tell us about smallage.
Smallage is an interesting plant. It's related to celery. It's, in essence, a leafy celery or a wild celery, and it is a biennial plant. So it grows for 2 years. On the second year, it produces seeds, and then it dies off. This is another vegetable or herb that stays green well into January or February, so it's great to have. And unlike our modern celery, you pinch off the outer leaves and stems and use them raw in salads, or you can cook them and use them in cooked dishes. And this celery has a little bit of a stronger flavor than celery as we know it now. And it's useful because you don't harvest the whole plant at once. It just keeps going in the garden, and you've always got some.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
That's why I like that one.
And where you are in Plymouth, that is what, zone 5 horticulturally?
No, more like zone 6.
Zone 6. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because you're on the water, so it's probably a little more temperate, right?
Right.
Right. Uh-huh.
So let's talk about purslane. I spend an awful lot of time pulling purslane.
Me too.
Tell us about the attributes of purslane.
Well, purslane in some parts of the world, the Middle East being one of them, is a staple vegetable.
Uh-huh.
It's got a citrusy or a citric flavor. It's a succulent,
yes.
So it's very refreshing, and that's another one that will stay green well into the winter. It seeds in, and so you've always got it going. No matter how much you use, you seem to always have more coming up.
Yes.
So it's an easy and handy addition to the garden.
My parents ate that with tomato and onion. It was
wow.
It was a, yeah, it was a salt, olive oil, purslane, red onion, and tomato in the summer.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know.
Now, did they buy purslane or
No, they just pulled it out of the garden. And because they grew organically, they didn't spray anything. But you're right. No matter how much we ate, and after a while, us children would detest it. We'd pick it out of our salads and just eat the tomatoes. But it always came back. Like
right.
If you leave a tiny bit of a stem,
yeah.
That's it. It'll come back. It seems like literally overnight that
it's actually a very handsome plant.
It's
I actually
not bad
like
looking.
The way it looks.
Yeah. But it takes up so much room. You know.
It is pretty. It's fairly low to the ground, so it can come in between things.
Uh-huh.
And that's represented in the English Village, right, Kelly? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is.
Hmm.
And what about gooseberry? Tell us about gooseberry. Do you guys have that?
Oh, I love gooseberry. It's wild here.
Uh-huh.
The pilgrims know it from England, too.
Uh-huh.
And there's a wonderful early 17th century receipt that we do. We cook them in a little clay pot called a pipkin over the fire with butter and sugar, and then we put it on top of bread. So that's buttered gooseberries.
Oh, my God. That sounds
it's
so
wonderful.
Good.
I love gooseberries.
And, all right, now, when I read this article from July 2011, it talked a lot about good King Henry lettuce. Do you all grow that?
We don't grow it in the English Village, although we do represent the plant in our humoral gardens and herb boxes that the public visit. And it also is a perennial vegetable. I think of it as spinach-like. It has arrow-shaped leaves. And it can be used raw or cooked in a pot as a vegetable. And I think that spinach being more prolific as an annual, spinach replaced it in popularity because it was so much easier to get large quantities of spinach.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
It's always a commerce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's always a commerce thing.
So when you... when you grow these, do you save the seeds and offer the seeds for sale of some of these historic plants in the shops or online for people to buy and to try to grow?
Both. We do have seeds for, I would say, 95% of the plants we grow in the village.
That's
we
great.
Have those available in the gift shop and online, so they are easily available.
That's great because I remember going to Monticello in Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's home, and they had great packages of seeds of the plants that he had grown, some historic plants.
Well, he has everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
You guys are a little more confined, you know, in your selection, I would imagine, than because of the history, you know?
Yeah.
So, Kelly, tell us what your day consists of at the gardens at the historic homes.
Well, I'm a pilgrim, and again, every year I'm a different pilgrim.
Right.
You know, I have my own house and garden, and it's just wonderful. We stop planting fairly early. By the end of March, we're starting to plant, you know, spinach and cold weather, like garden peas, things like that.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, more in April. Some things we don't plant until June, like cucumbers and beans, things like that in the gardens. They're kitchen gardens, so it's a combination of physic herbs, salad herbs, and pot herbs. And the housewives are making simple physic for their families. It's critical that they are saving seeds so they can have them the next spring. you know, the early years that we portray here in Plymouth, they're getting supplies maybe once a year. So it's very critical that the housewives are saving those seeds and,
right,
and keeping them dry through the winter so they can plant again in the spring.
Right. Hang on, guys. We have to take a break. It's time for a break. Hang on to the line. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
This one is called Everything She Touches by Four Lincolns on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Walking home alone, so enlightened, no one's listening. Everything she touches turns to gold, turns to gold, turns to gold. And everything she touches turns to gold. She's all alone, she turns to gold. She turns to gold. Flown in with the wrong kind of dreamers, flown in where you don't belong. Running from your shadow is only a matter of time before it catches you. And everything she touches turns to gold, turns to gold. Touches tons of gold. She's all alone. She turns to gold.
Finds herself on the brighter side. Looks for ambition in a snow-covered night. With the face of an angel and the mind of a child.
Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hedeka. After visiting Christie's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn. They found a number of purposes for the slate and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. They now make regular trips to the family quarry in upstate New York to hand-pick their favorite pieces of black and red slate. Some of the slate is sourced from the quarry graveyard, a collection of odd-shaped pieces that were ultimately destined to be ground for use as road cover or baseball diamonds. They then transport the pieces to their studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, where they do additional cutting and clean the stone to be food slate. Every single piece of packaging that comes with their products, from the envelope to the burlap bag, can be repurposed for other uses. The end result is a product completely unique in cut, shape, color, and overall presentation. For more information and to order, visit brooklynslate.com.
Hi, welcome. You're back on We Dig Plants. Today we have our Thanksgiving show with us as guests from up north in Massachusetts. We have Lori Danick and Kelly Arujo joining us from Plymouth Plantation again. So we wanted to ask you ladies, and either one of you can chime in, what seeds did the original pilgrims on the Mayflower bring with them? What plant seeds did they feel were essential for their first year there?
Well, we're actually not sure. We know that they sow barley and peas,
mm-hmm.
and that the earliest planting of garden beds is March 7th, 1620.
Okay.
And that's the earliest, you know, primary source that we have. The William Bradford's first that I had mentioned before, that's typical, you know, parsnips, carrots, turnips. But we don't have early documentation for 1620, what they had brought over other than the peas and the barley.
So they landed in September, is that right?
No, they actually leave Plymouth, England, September 6th.
Oh, okay.
20, and they arrive here. They sight Cape Cod November 9th.
So they had to make... Yes, I see. So they had to make it through the winter with whatever stores they had and whatever they found, right?
That's right. That's right. And the delay, you know, they got delayed in England, so
yes.
With another ship.
Yes.
So they don't start even building a house in Plymouth, a new Plymouth, until Christmas Day, 1620.
Wow.
And so, but to, they plant early, March 7th, and that's out of Mort's Relation, a little book, a primary source book that we study. And that's early. It's cold here.
Yes, yes.
It's still frozen, right?
Are there any original sources talking about the soil and what they've like what they thought about? You know, because they really had no idea what kind of soil or landscape they were going to encounter, right? What did they think about it compared to England, where they were probably farming for centuries and had been plowed, you know, so much? What did they think about breaking this soil? And you know, there, is there any original information about that?
Yes. Again, Mort's Relation and, of course, William Bradford's Journal of Plymouth Plantation. And they mention how in some places it's sandy-like, some's like clay-like, and the climate is it's much longer, harder, colder winters and hotter summers. So they have to, you know, change their planting method, you know, timing.
Yeah. And a lot of techniques. Tell us about that. How did they fertilize? I mean, there's the mythic, you know, planting the fish with the corn that supposedly the Native Americans taught them. But what did they use? What were their techniques
for that first spade in the soil? What was Do you have any information on that?
Well, right, Squanto. Tisquantum had he had shown them how to set and dress native corn with herring. And that's, maize, that was their, that's what they grew the most of. That first year, they sowed 20 acres of maize.
Oh, wow.
Along with the barley and peas, although the peas got burnt up.
Yes.
So that was their maize. And they had found that on the Cape. They found maize and they found beans in their early explorations. As far as the garden beds, early on, well, we're not even sure how many animals they had brought on the Mayflower with them. We know there are a few dogs, there's a mastiff and a spaniel, but as far as compost or dung, there, you know, the year we portray now in 1627, it's a mixture of, chicken dung, goat dung, cow dung, and scraps from the house, For compost.
Oh,
it's so, all, you know, it's all organic. It's
of course.
Shells and lobster shells, clam shells, mussel shells.
So they had no tradition in England of using fish as fertilizer necessarily?
Not that I know of, other than, you know, if there's some scraps of bones in the compost or in the compost. Herring here in New England is what's first they put herring in the hill and they keep it there for 2 weeks and then they put in
and then the corn.
Then they put in seed and it's interesting. They would at night the wolves would come and try to dig up the herring out of the field.
I would imagine. So, did they eat a lot of seafood as well? I mean,
oh,
it must have been so abundant. I can only imagine. I bet they probably could have caught a fish with their hand in some of the creeks, you know?
There was a lot of lobster, too, at the time, and I think they ate so much lobster that they tired of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the first things they eat when the Mayflower arrives on the Cape are mussels.
Yeah. I love mussels. Yeah.
Well, that would have been familiar to them from England, right?
Yeah.
Because
sure. I mean, yeah, I think, well, here I think, in especially in the summer here, they become, like Laurie had said, cloyed with lobsters, and it's just so much of it.
Yeah.
Although no oysters here in this bay, they got them from Mass Bay. But yeah, so as far as early compost in the gardens, you know, it becomes the combination of the cow, chicken, goat, sheep dung, and scraps from the house.
Boy, that first year must have just been so scary, you know.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing, you know, that 50. That they do, they sow the 20 acres of corn, of maize.
Right. 20 acres, that's a good amount. That's impressive.
The year that you're representing there, Plymouth Plantation, in 1627, at that point, a couple of replenishment ships had come, right, to bring more supplies at that point. So 7 years on, do you get a sense that they were starting to feel comfortable, not thinking about heading back, resigned to the fact that, okay, this might work. Is that the sense that you get from the history?
I think, you know, it's pretty hard. It's a wilderness, you know. And,
still, yeah.
Yeah, they're getting supplies maybe once a year. So it's a tough early beginning. Some folks go back. They can't brook, you know, take it. It's too hard.
I saw on your website that really hilarious garden design for the New World. I forget some British aristocracy drew up what the homestead should look like. And I thought, what a jerk. You know, there you are, like drawing this plan, you know, and you have no knowledge of anything that these people are going through, you know?
Right.
I wonder if the first, because the land hadn't been, the parcels of land that they were working hadn't been depleted of nutrients. I bet they probably had a decent harvest at first, right?
Well, you know, the earliest mention of that, again, is in Mort's Relation, and it's our harvest being gotten in. The governor sent out 4 men fouling, and that's when Massasoit came with 90 men, and they ended up feasting and entertaining for a few days. And Massasoit, they had brought 5 deer.
Wow.
With them.
Oh, my God.
So there was, you know, here where the pilgrims stayed, there had been a village here, a native village.
Oh, okay.
And so there had been remnants of corn hills. This is, you know, Patuxet.
Uh-huh.
And this is where Squanto was from. So this is, there weren't any gardens, but there were remnants of corn.
Right. So are you guys growing any fruits at the museum?
Yes, we do have several fruits. We've been growing wild strawberries and planting them outside the village in places that they would have grown wild. Gooseberries, currants, beech plums, melons. There are several types of wild grapes and wild blueberries, plus cranberries.
The cranberries, yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the English at first called them marsh berries because they grew in in or around wet places.
And you're still growing them, right? Are you cultivating any varieties or are they all wild and you've?
Well, we grow the native varieties. We research plants from descriptions that exist in the 17th century, and we find plants or seed sources that will produce the closest approximation of plants as they were long ago.
Okay.
I have a question for you, Lori. So what, based on your experience there and what you know of the history, what is the biggest misconception you think people have about
The
Thanksgiving feast, or Thanksgiving in general,
and the pilgrims.
What is really the biggest misconception that most people, whether visitors or people that you've spoken to, have about it?
Well, I think people assume that the pilgrims and the Wampanoag Indians sat down and had a feast similar to our Thanksgiving today, but the food served were not what we would think of as the traditional Thanksgiving dinner. What would you say, Kelly?
The first harvest feast is, I think, what we've taken in, you know, and again, Thanksgiving now, because the Puritans and the group of separatists that went to Holland, they're keeping days of Thanksgiving that are religious days of fasting and prayer. So there's a little, you know, there's a difference in that. And, you know, English harvest feasts, that's traditional. If you get a good harvest, you have a harvest feast. And this one was special. You know, it's the first one.
Right.
With just the 50, and Massasoit comes, and they end up feasting for a few days. And, you know, that's very special.
Yeah.
And this, so they ate, you said they had venison, they had some of the native turkeys.
Probably geese and ducks, pumpkin.
Did they actually eat together? What does the historical record say? Did they actually sit down together and eat, or did they just, you know, did the Native Americans bring, you know, bring the deer meat and other things and just kind of leave it there? How did it, what do you know of that?
Again, you know, out of Mort's relation, that first harvest gotten in, the natives come amongst them, and their greatest king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom for three days we entertained and feasted, and they went out and killed five deer and brought to the plantation and bestowed on the governor and the captain and others.
Interesting.
And, you know, so that's the first description of the first harvest feast in 1621.
And only the men came, right? The women and children probably did not.
They might have. We don't know.
If only our politics could be so simple today, you know? So do you guys use any of the vegetables that you grow in the kitchen for these dinners?
Well, in the village... In 1627 Village, everything we grow on site, we cook. So it's wonderful. It's all organic. But Laurie has a few things to mention about that, too.
Yes. We have a farmer's market here at the museum.
Oh, cool.
It's weekly during the growing season and once a month during the winter months. And we harvest our surplus herbs and vegetables in the English Village, and we sell that at the farmers market for the museum. And I also grow organic herbs and vegetables in my greenhouse here and sell those at the farmers market.
I have to say, I think that is probably the best farmers market in the United States. You know? I mean, it's on the original land. Like, that is brilliant.
Yeah.
And I hope you guys get a lot of marketing mileage out of that.
We do. People love the vegetables and herbs, and we also sell vegetables and herbs, unlike those that can be found anywhere else, such as the salad burnet or maybe, what else, the borage salad burnet.
Oh, I want to go.
I want
to go to that market. If I live near there, that's the market that I would go to.
Oh, totally. Completely.
It can be really interesting.
Well, let me just... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, it's fun to tell people about these plants that they've never heard of or seen before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I have to say one thing about how wonderful it is for me as a pilgrim costume interpreter to have children... want to help me in the garden, plant seeds and pull weeds, and they water for me, and their parents are amazed when I get their children to do work for me, and they love it. And, you know, when a child comes in and says to me, "You have a beautiful garden," it just, you know, it takes my breath away sometimes.
Yeah.
And I hope, you know, that I plant a seed in there to get them thinking about having their own garden someday.
That's the thing. We're all so removed, you know. We're so removed from it. And for us, you know, vegetables are found at the supermarket.
Like, and kids are generally very willing to, especially young children, are very willing to...
get dirty.
To get dirty, you know.
Yeah, they love it.
So do you have to garden in costume, Kelly? Or can you wear... You do? That's rough.
I do.
How hot is that?
In the summer.
It's interesting. You get used to it, though. I've been, you know, for here for a little while. So you get used to it. And
how heavy is the costume?
Oh, boy. Sometimes I have two or three layers of clothes on.
Yeah. I know. I was going to say, is it made out of... is it made out of cotton, or is it? Do they use, like, you know, heavy
damask?
You know,
you're right. It's wool, linen, and canvas.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's intense.
Yeah, I have a lot of empathy for our early early housewives.
I mean, the men at least got to wear pants. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
They do have breeches, yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, Kelly wears a corset.
I do.
So bending is next to impossible.
I would pass
Holy
out.
Yeah.
But you get to wear a nice hat to cover your, you know.
I do love hats.
Well, you have some great upcoming events and activities at the museum that we'd like to plug for you all. Lori, I see that you're hosting a wreath-making workshop on December 1st.
Yes, and also November 30th, because the December 1st event is filled up.
Oh, great.
I've done this workshop for about 10 years now, and people come. They make a wreath out of evergreens. On our property here, we have a marvelous selection of different evergreen trees that we cut the greens from. And I teach them a technique that they can use year-round making any sort of wreath. And it's the kickoff of my holiday season and many of the people who come to the workshop. So
yeah.
That's a lot of fun.
How many visitors do you guys get a year?
I would say about 350,000.
Wow.
And at this time of year, we can get a few thousand school children every day.
Yeah.
So
wow.
It's something to see.
Is this the busiest time between Thanksgiving and Christmas?
It is.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a downtime? March?
Well, we open in March, and it can be brutal weather outside, so maybe that would be our slowest season.
Okay.
Although we do have many events going on at that time, so it can be, busy.
Yeah. And you guys are offering an Old World Christmas at the Grist Mill and Breakfast with Santa at the Plantation. That's December 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
I think I'd like to go. You know, I went to Williamsburg in Virginia for Thanksgiving, and it was great. It was a great time of year. We spent three days there, and the whole family. It was a great way to spend the Thanksgiving,
right?
And lots of activities. I think I want to go up to Plymouth one year, and.
I have to confess to you, ladies, this is very close to my heart because my husband's mother's side of the family, there's a John Alden, and so we just named our son Alden from the family, so we definitely have to bring him up there.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
he's off the Mayflower.
He's right off the Mayflower. So
he is.
Yeah, well, thank you ladies so much for joining us and shedding some light on gardening at the museum and that very first Thanksgiving and what really happened versus...
Well, thank you so much. I hope to see you someday.
And the website is plymouth.org, is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
It is Plimoth.
Exactly.
Okay. Plymouth.org. So check it out. They have some really fun interactive stuff where you can learn how to speak the old English.
And talk like a pilgrim.
Yeah. I checked that out. It's really fun for kids to to try that out. And please, listeners, join our Facebook fan page. You can win free prizes weekly at random. We're giving away books. We're giving away tools, all kinds of stuff to keep you gardening through the winter season. I want to thank Joe G for engineering and Jack Inslee for producing the show. Thank you for listening. There's still time to get a heritage turkey at Heritage Foods USA. Keep gardening and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Lori and Kelly.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.